Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. Tonight's topic will be the continuance of the purported and never ratified 14th Amendment. This will be the final show on this subject. Due to lack of interest, I'm not going to follow up with any of the other things that I mentioned in my previous shows on this topic, for whatever reason, no one is listening. So, a handful of downloads on my last show. Now, I realize this topic is very dry, but it is one of the most important topics. Now, maybe if someone else wants to do the subject, they can make it more, perhaps, entertaining. But I just want to say that I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to inform. And if anyone is looking for entertainment, you're never going to get it out of my show. The closest thing to entertainment you are going to get from me is my selection of music. Now, I don't know what my next topic will be. I haven't thought about it yet. I have to reconsider based upon what I was intending to do as extra shows now. And so we'll see what happens next week. But in the meantime, I'm going to tell Eric that there won't be a follow-up show. And maybe at some point in the future, if enough people do become interested in this topic, I will do it then. But I'm not going to now. So I just, you know, I'm just not going to get up here and talk for 2 hours for a handful of people. So anyway, for the record, today is September 1st, 2013 on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 9 degrees Virgo. Be sure and give listen to all the other hosts here on Renegade. Kyle on Mondays, Lou on Tuesdays, Dana on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, the Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. I will not monitor the chat because I'm doing the show at like 1:30 in the morning my time. You're hearing a recording unless you are listening to my personal Blog Talk Radio account at the moment. Speaking of which, I actually had more listeners on that than I did Renegade. And the show was not even advertised. And I created it, like an hour before I did it. And I got more listeners from off of Blog Talk Radio. So, anyway, we do have a chat, though, at renegadebroadcasting.com. I don't know if there will be a live feed or stream tonight, as I will not be around to find out. I have plans, and I'm going to enjoy the rest of what's left of this weekend. And there's also the same chat at renegadebroadcasting.chatango.com. And the same chat over at alternativesocial.com. I want to remind everybody about nationalprotectionism.com. And also our new website, renegadetribune.com. Again, I have no personal website or blog. I probably wouldn't have a life if I did. And I probably wouldn't be able to do these shows. So if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That's magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe. Otherwise, just write me. I can't guarantee I'll get to all of my emails. And if you have sent me a subscription, I will get you on there on the next mail out. I was hoping to get that item mailed out that I mentioned last week by this weekend, but it just didn't happen. Things are just very unpredictable at the moment, put it that way. No calls tonight. I'm pretty much going to make that a standard rule. Don't know where the cat is. She wasn't here earlier. The dog is probably going to wind up being a pest again. He's in the next room, though. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play another song, and I'll wrap this up, and this show will basically be down and dirty. I will read whatever I've got on this one article, and whatever time it takes is however long the show will be. If it's 1 hour, the show will be 1 hour. If it takes an hour and a half, the show will be an hour and a half. If it takes 2 hours and 10 minutes, it will be 2 hours and 10 minutes. I don't know how long it is, but I'm not planning on going into any other articles. I just don't see the point at this point. So anyway, come on, computer, play the song.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we get started, the last show I had discussed the court case of Texas versus White, which the Supreme Court used as a tool to rule on secession. And what I've got here is a brief clip from a, I don't know what to call it. It was a speech or a lecture or something of that nature. That it's real brief, and it kind of explains what the Supreme Court was trying to do with that case, because ruling on secession had nothing to do with what the case was about. The court just took advantage of that to rule on it, to make its point, try to set a precedent. Of course, had they ever put Jefferson Davis on trial, even though they held him for a year before they just released him, that would have totally destroyed any arguments about secession, because he certainly would have done some severe damage to what the those up north who took over the country, who were lying in wait for 75 years to change our government, were trying to do. So anyway, here we go. If I can get this.
All right, you guys want to take a 5-minute break real quick? Construction. I'm not going to cover a lot of this, but suffice it to say, the one thing that you're going to need to understand out of this whole reconstruction issue is the United States government took its boot heel and tried to stomp the crap out of us. You know, it was a lot of retribution. And the one thing out of this section, and I want you to go back and read this when you get a chance, but the one thing out of this section that is extremely important is Texas versus White. Because you hear, in relation to the secession of Texas, even today, you hear about Texas versus White. It's a Supreme Court case that was about bond money, bonds that were issued. And the Supreme Court decided to utilize that case as an opportunity to decide on the legality or constitutionality of secession. Now, let me tell you something about Texas versus White. It is the biggest joke that you have ever seen. And let me explain to you this comedy of errors that is known as Texas versus White. First and foremost, the Supreme Court Chief Justice was at one point a minister in Lincoln's cabinet. It was packed with Lincoln appointees, okay? So these guys were hell-bent on retribution against the states that had seceded. So that's one particular factor. Many of these guys probably should have recused themselves from that case. But the fact that Texas versus White had absolutely nothing to do with secession, they decided that they would use this as an opportunity to say that secession is unconstitutional. Now, some things about Texas versus White that are extremely, we'll actually get to this. But I just want you to know that that's when it happened, was this whole issue of during the Reconstruction, Texas versus White. So it gives you a time frame. People talk about it. It was right after the Civil War when they were trying to grind this under their boot heel. Okay. Now, next on is the...
Okay. He didn't have a lot to say about it that was that interesting, but he made a good point, and that was the whole purpose of me playing that. So anyway, I'm going to skip down to the dissection of the 14th Amendment in this article that I was reading last time, and I'm going to totally skip the Reconstruction Acts that were that are in here prior to this section. So anyway, this will break it down into each section and kind of give a synopsis of it. So anyway, begin. The validity, or should we say invalidity, of the Civil War amendments is very important to reinstating the inalienable rights of free white citizens in the United States of America. At every juncture where the government of the United States of America and or the governments of the several states attempt to assert inalienable rights, the Civil War amendments are ultimately claimed to be the authority for such deprivation of rights. To determine whether the 14th Amendment is fact or fiction, We'll proceed to dissect each section of the 14th Amendment, sentence by sentence. Please remember that the following authorities reflects the understanding of the Founding Fathers at the time the Constitution for the United States was adopted. And although they may not be politically correct today, the authorities represent the law at the time the 14th Amendment was purportedly adopted. One more thing I wanted to mention before I forget. You know, I know a lot of the people here are not in the United States, but things that affect us as a whole, no matter where we live, are important. And if something's going on, we ought to talk about it. Something's going on in Europe, we need to talk about it. Something going on in Canada, we need to talk about it, or New Zealand, or whatever the case may be. And so, you know, I got to have a good feeling that a good portion of the reason for the lack of listening to this show was the fact that a good portion of the people may not even be in the United States. But unfortunately, if that's your perception, well, that's your perception, but so be it. Let me relight this cigarette one out. 14th Amendment, Section 1. We begin with Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Sounds very innocent, doesn't it? First sentence of Section 1 provides all persons born or naturalized in the United States. Notice there is no relation to race and there is no definition of person other than the P in the person, word person, is not capitalized, indicating the word would not mean a natural person, but a juristic person or artificial person. And this gets into what Mike was talking about. Basically, it's corporate. Now, I will say this. I'm not reading from the article here. I'm interjecting this. Notice the bills that you get when they come to you. They're all in capital letters. If you have a birth certificate from prior to the time you reach the age of majority, whatever the law is in your state, with the physician signature and all, of course, you'll notice that your name is, the only letters that are capitalized are the first letters of each section of your name. Now, if you look on a grave or a marker on a grave site, whatever the case is, headstone, you'll notice that the names of the person who is buried there is in all capital letters. Essentially, what that means is the person is dead. Well, corporations are not alive, so they're considered dead. Well, now, are you dead or alive? Well, obviously you're alive, but why do your bills and everything to you, especially from the government, you get something from the IRS or Social Security Administration or unemployment or welfare or whatever, it's in all capital letters. Look at your bank statement. Everything is in all capital letters. Therefore, you are an artificial person. Now, this is some of the stuff that I was going to get into with Eric, but so much for that for the time being anyway. Okay, now let's see here. As the courts have said, due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment apply to corporations which are juristic or artificial persons. Now let's compare this with Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4 of the Constitution of the United States of America. No person except a natural born citizen. Now, since you're not here to see this, I will have to explain it. If you'll notice in that, when you look at it, the N in no, the P in person and the C in citizen. All of the capitalization is only on the object to be discussed as to who is a natural person. Okay, so you have uppercase no, uppercase person. Everything else is lowercase except for citizen. No person except a natural born citizen. This is further clarified in a court case called Amy versus Smith. Okay, in Amy versus Smith, free Negroes and mulattoes are almost everywhere considered and treated as a degraded race of people, in so much so that under the Constitution and law of the United States, they cannot become citizens of the United States. Again, that was Amy versus Smith. In light of this, no person should be considered as a United States citizen or a citizen of the United States, as the Constitution was framed to incorporate the common law in opposition to international law. Common law, one race governs. International law, all races govern. The capitalization of the words person and citizen could only mean one thing, the denoting of only those of one race in compliance with the common law. The American colonies brought with them the common and not the civil law in each state at the Revolution, adopted either more or less of it, and not one of them exploded the principle, the place of birth conferred citizenship. That was Amy versus Smith as well. Now, the United States was based upon common law. Roman civil law has been brought in most places in the country, except in Louisiana, where you have French civil code, which I guess might be expected. Louisiana is a strange place. Don't know if any of you have ever been there. I know Mike has. They don't have counties there. They have parishes instead. And I consider Louisiana to be very corrupt, perhaps close to being on the lines of Chicago. And I've always referred to Louisiana as a better organized Mexico. That's how bad it is. I don't go there. You drive through there and you got Texas license plates. Well, they're looking to make some money, so they're going to try and pull you over for the least little thing. Just for fun, let's talk about that a little bit. There was a report in the news back, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, where traffic cops were pulling people over for what they called lane violations. In other words, if you drifted from one side of your lane to the other versus staying right down the middle, they would pull you over and write you up for a ticket for lane violations. They've also been notorious over there about just taking people's money. So all I can say to anybody is, if you ever go through Louisiana, be careful, drive the speed limit, get in and out as fast as possible. I need to clear my throat. Under the common law and under the American Constitution, and this includes the states' constitutions, by the way, as well, citizenship was dependent upon right of inheritance, which can only be passed by lineage, race. Now, this is what I've discussed about your inalienable rights are coming from your creator. Well, you know, all your Christian fools want to say, well, your creator was Jehovah. See, they don't understand this. Your rights are inherited. You know, the founding fathers were not Christian. And by the way, I do kind of find it interesting how it is that the Patriot Movement, which is comprised mainly of Christians, are so interested in this, but the nationalist movements have never got into this for whatever reason. They just don't understand the importance of it. However, the Patriot Movement will ignore all the racial issues. So I'm trying to bring to light the racial issues in it, which is the reality of the matter. Okay, I'll continue. This is in accord with the preamble of the Constitution of the United States of America, which states that the Constitution was adopted for the protection of we the people and their posterity. Posterity being a racial term. The P in persons of the 14th Amendment is not referring to those referred to in Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States of America. Notice the word subject. It says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Okay, those that were not of the white race when the 14th Amendment was proposed were natural-born subjects. Now I'm going to read something from Commentaries of American Law by James Kent, 7th edition, volume 2. Blacks, whether born or in bondage, if born under the jurisdiction and allegiance of the United States, are natives and not aliens. They are what the common law terms natural-born subjects. The better opinion, I should think, was that Negroes or other slaves born within and under the allegiance of the United States are natural-born subjects but not citizens. Citizens, under our Constitution and laws, mean free inhabitants born within the United States or naturalized under the law of Congress. Thus we find the meaning and application of the terms subject to the jurisdiction. A United States citizen, that is, a common law citizen in one of the several states at the adoption of the Constitution for the United States of America, was considered within the jurisdiction of the United States. Citizens were never subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Instead, the United States was subject to the jurisdiction of the citizen, that is, under the common law. See the 10th article in Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. According to the common law principle upon which our Constitution was founded, only the race of people forming the sovereignty to adopt the Constitution, we the people, are considered citizens. All others born inside the country and owing allegiance to we the people are natural born subjects. Under principles of international law, that is, interracial law, see definition in Webster's Dictionary, 1828, these subjects, who by special privilege are licensed to become something or do something normally illegal under the common law, are said to be citizens and persons. But in considering the question before us, it must be borne in mind that there is no law of nations standing between the people of the United States and their government and interfering with their relation to each other. The powers of the government and the rights of the citizens under it are positive and practical regulations plainly written down. The people of the United States have delegated to it certain enumerated powers and forbidden it to exercise others. Now, what I just read came from Dred Scott versus Sanford, 1856 through 1857. It is clear that the 14th Amendment could not be referring to the citizens that are known of the white race, but must be referring to those artificial citizens of the non-white races. From the 14th Amendment, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. This sentence is interesting, as it not only declares that these persons, using a small p, are citizens, using a small c, or lowercase, when I say small, of the United States, but also of the state they choose to reside in. And this is from Van Valkenburg versus Brown, 1872. No white person born within the limits of the United States, or born without those limits, and subsequently naturalized under their laws, owes the status of citizenship to the recent amendments to the federal constitution. Prior to the, now this one is from Sharon versus Hill, 1885. prior to the adoption of this amendment, strictly speaking, there were no citizens of the United States, but only someone of them. Congress had the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, but not the power to make a naturalized alien a citizen of any state. But the states generally provided that such persons might, on sufficient residence therein, become citizens thereof, and then the courts held ab conveniente, rather than otherwise, that they became ipso facto citizens of the United States. You'll notice the words, someone of them. Okay. I was looking to see where that sentence was again. Okay, anyway, this refers to citizenship of someone of the states. I'll have to scroll back to see if I can find that. Let me see if I can see where that was. Okay, I don't see it offhand. I'd have to go back and read the part of it, so we'd be backtracking. So I'm just going to continue. Just use your button to go backwards when you're listening to this show, and you'll catch it again. The national government had no power to make citizens of its own and force them upon the states. The states could make anyone they choose to be a citizen of their state, but only those of the white race could be recognized as national citizens under the preamble to the Constitution for the United States of America and be treated as citizens in any state they entered. Thus, only white state citizens held the privileges and immunities known to Article 4, Section 2 among the several states, and no state could confer that constitutional protection on any other race. In consequence thereof, the word also could not authorize a non-white to be an officer of the United States government. These elements were what was referred to as national citizenship prior to the 14th Amendment. To avoid one state or the states collectively at the national level from interfering in another state's sovereignty or the sovereignty we the people. And that's all rather interesting. Bet you didn't know that. The 14th Amendment attempts to reverse this natural common law order of things by making state citizenship dependent upon national citizenship. And this is from U.S. versus Hall, 1871. By the original Constitution, citizenship in the United States was a consequence of citizenship in a state. By this clause, I'm referring to Amendment 14, Section 1, this order of things is reversed. Citizenship in the United States is defined. It is made independent of citizenship in a state, and the citizenship in a state is a result of citizenship in the United States, so that a person born or naturalized in the United States and subject to its jurisdiction is, without reference to state constitutions or laws, entitled to all privileges and immunities secured by the Constitution of the United States to citizens thereof. Now, the next one I'm going to read is from that same court case, Sharon versus Hill. Prior to the adoption of this amendment, strictly speaking, there were no citizens of the United States, but only someone of them. Congress had the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, but not the power to make a naturalized alien a citizen of any state. But the states generally provided that such persons might, on sufficient residence therein, become citizens thereof, and then the courts held ab conveniente than otherwise, that they became ipso facto citizens of the United States. Notice the words ab conveniente. That's A-B-C-O-N-V-E-N-I-E-N-T-I, which means after the event. This means after the Constitutional Convention. And the words ipso facto, which interprets as after the sovereignty was established, composed only of members of the white race. The choice of words here is interesting, as they did not use the words N-U-N-C pro T-U-N-C. I guess that's nunc pro tunc, or tunc, nunc pro tunc, which means to do what should have been done in the beginning. In other words, they are not saying they made a mistake by not including other races when the Constitution was framed. They are only claiming to change the order of things regardless of the correctness of the original circumstance. This section of the 14th Amendment totally dissolves the states, meaning people of the state, right to declare its own sovereign body. It is in violation of state sovereignty and completely violates Article 4, Sections 2 and 4, and the 9th and 10th Articles in Amendment. Let me read those. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. No person held to service or labor in any one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered upon claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. Now, from the 9th article of the in amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, from the 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. To understand that, not only Article 4, but all other articles, 1 through 7, were written only for the government of and for the white race, thereby barring those not of the white race from coming under their protection. You are referred to the case of Crandall versus Connecticut. And I will read that. The first Congress after the Constitution was adopted was composed of many of those distinguished patriots who framed the Constitution, and from that circumstance would be supposed to know what its spirit was. Some of the earliest work they performed for the country was to establish by law a uniform rule of naturalization. The first law was by Congress in 1790, and in its precise and technical language is used: an alien, being a free white person, may become a citizen by complying with the requirements hereinafter named. In the year 1795, a further regulation was made by law when the same language was used: any free white person may become a citizen. In 1798, 1802, 1813, and 1824, similar laws were passed on the same subject, and in each of those laws, the same technical language is used. These laws were carrying into effect the Constitution itself, and if the Constitution in any part of it embraced colored persons or citizens, then Congress mistook its duty and early departed from its provisions. Congress have also marked this distinction of color in the post office laws. No person of color can be engaged in the post office or in the transportation of mail. This is a right open to all but persons of color. How odd, considering most of the postal workers are black today. Of course, it's not the United States Post Office. It's the Postal Service. Notice the distinction. It's a private corporation. It is not the government. Yet they will claim all of the rights of being a government employee, of being a civil servant. Go figure. From the same, Crandall versus Connecticut, 1834. To my mind, it would be a perversion of terms in the well-known rule of construction to say that slaves, free blacks, or Indians were citizens within the meaning of that term as used in the Constitution. God forbid that I should add to the degradation of this race of men, but I am bound by my duty to say they are not citizens. I have thus shown you that this law is not contrary to the second section of the fourth article of the Constitution of the United States, for that embraces only citizens. Note the word citizen as it is used in Crandall, the case I just read. For the definition of the word citizen, we refer you to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 8th edition, dated 1859. For the word citizen, or persons. Notice they're the same. Of course, here it says citizen. Actually, what's interesting here is that citizen is the word that's being looked up, so it's capitalized. But under these, right after it, it says persons, period, and then it begins a sentence. Okay, so the first one is citizen, comma, persons, period, three, period. All natives are not citizens of the United States, semicolon. The descendants of the aborigines, comma, and those of African origin, comma, are not entitled to the rights of citizens, period. Anterior to the adoption of the Constitution of the United States, comma, each state had the right to make citizens of such persons as it pleased, period. That Constitution does not authorize any but white persons to become citizens of the United States, semicolon, and it must therefore be presumed that no one is a citizen who is not white. Now, under the same dictionary, same edition, same year, citizen, comma, persons, period, two, period, citizens are either native-born or naturalized, period. Native citizens may fill any office, semicolon. Naturalized citizens may be elected or appointed to any office under the Constitution of the United States, comma, except the office of President and Vice President, period. The Constitution provides, comma, that the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, period. This leaves no doubt who, under the organic law of this nation, if you want to use the word nation, we're not a nation, are sorely defined as citizens or persons, or what race is the sovereign body. No one else is included. The 14th Amendment is an attempt to unseat the organic law, and we should question any and all government officials who would condone this type of deception. You see, you've got ammo here. You've got some huge ammunition. I'm just totally frustrated as to why people don't find this information of any value. Notice in government reprints of the Constitution for the United States of America, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their number. According to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed 3/5 of all persons. Upon checking the Constitution of the Confederate States of America, the people of the Confederacy, who knew and understood the organic law of this then nation, if you want to refer to it that way, even though really it was a confederation of nation states, reworded the preamble and Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 as follows. We, the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in its sovereign and independent character in order to form a permanent federal government, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invoking the favor and guidance of Almighty God, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the Confederate States of America. Now, the next one here, it says, and this is from Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the same Constitution of the Confederate States. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this Confederacy, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all slaves. Now, again, I'll have to explain this. It says, notice we the people and to ourselves and our posterity were preserved. Also notice the substitution of the word persons for that of the word slaves. Okay. Now, let's see if I can find. No, I'd have to scroll back to read the American version of it, and I would lose my spot. So if you need to hear it, look it up. You can find it on Wikipedia real easy, or just put this in reverse. Okay, under the 14th Amendment, Section 1, purported 14th Amendment, Section 1, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. This sentence of the 14th Amendment, Section 1, makes all state constitutions which set their sovereign body as the white race only, such as Oregon's Constitution, null and void. Oregon Constitution, 1859, Article 2, Section 2. In all elections not otherwise provided for by this Constitution, every white male citizen of the United States and others, such as the Georgia Constitution in 1865, Article 5, Section 1, the electors or members of the General Assembly shall be free white male citizens of the state. Let me clear my throat. From the North Carolina Constitution, 1856, Article 1, Section 3, Clause 2, every free white man at the age of 21 years being a native or naturalized citizen of the United States. The Virginia Constitution, 1830, Article 3, Section 14. Every white male citizen of the Commonwealth, resident therein, aged 21 years and upwards, being qualified to exercise the right of suffrage. The Maryland Constitution, 1810, Article 14. That every white male citizen of this state above 21 years of age and neither having resided 12 months within the state and 6 months in the country. From the Delaware Constitution, 1792, Article 4, Section 1. All elections of governors, senators, and representatives shall be by ballot, and in such elections, every white free man of the age of 21 years. Let's see here. It says also, see Neal versus Delaware as to the nullification of state constitutions under the 14th Amendment. All of these provisions of the constitutions for the states are now null and void. If the 14th Amendment is considered as a valid amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, which it is certainly not. No state legislature could change the governing class, which put the legislature into being, and which class was set in their own state constitution. Here, we must also note the difference between the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause and the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, Section 2. C. Maxwell versus Dow. And it says 14th Amendment, Section 1. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person therein its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Notice how close the wording of this sentence of the 14th Amendment is to the wording of the 5th Article in Amendment. Nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And again, that was last one, was in the 5th Article in Amendment of the Constitution. Note the 14th Amendment deviates from the 5th Article in Amendment on the issue of compensation. The 14th Amendment says equal protection, where the 5th Article in Amendment says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. The problem, it appears, in this change of wording is to give martial law properties to the 5th Article in Amendment, thereby converting the common law remedial effect of the 5th Article in Amendment to a martial law remedy. This could be why the courts use the word purview when referencing the articles in Amendment, Article 1 through 8, in relation to the 14th Amendment. Definition of purview from Black's Law Dictionary, 1979. That's the 5th edition. Purview: enacting part of a statute in contradistinction to the preamble. The part of a statute commencing with the words, "be it enacted," and continuing as far as the repealing clause, and hence the design, contemplation, purpose, or scope of the act. It appears that when the judges speak of any common law remedy, principle, or maxim as being within purview of the 14th Amendment, they are converting a common law remedy, principle, or maxim to a martial law remedy, principle, or maxim of law. In such cases, the common law remedy, principle, or maxim is eliminated, and of course, the unalienable rights of the citizen are also eliminated in favor of martial law rule. This conversion of the common law to properties of martial law nature is obvious. The 14th Amendment, with military force to enforce it, allows all races to govern, a maxim which violates the common law with the power or force of martial law. According to these principles, we must take another look at this portion of the 14th Amendment. What is due process under the 14th Amendment? Amazingly enough, due process is completely defined within the amendment by the integral words that follow those very terms, equal protection of the laws. Nothing more than equal protection of the law is required to satisfy the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Thus, equal tyranny and deprivation of common law rights to all meets the equal protection principle. So what protection is given? The answer: as much as the national government wishes to give and no more. Again, they're referring to it as national government. I would not use that word. Congressional protection can be enlarged and contracted as much as Congress and administrative agencies wish, provided only that these changes affect all equally. If everyone's changed to a post their own position, then they have equal protection of the law under the law martial. Now, notice I said the word congressal. I did not say congressional. That's what it says here. C-O-N-G-R-E-S-S-A-L. Let me clear my throat. clear to see the clear and inherent weakness of the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, and the common law principles clearly unto the do not like the 14th Amendment. Now, go ahead and take a short break. We still have about an hour into the show here, and I will most likely go into overtime the way it looks, just how much is left. So anyway, let me go ahead and play a song here, and I'll be right back.
I tried to make it Sunday, but I got so damn depressed that I set my sights on Monday, and I got myself undressed. I ain't ready for the altar, but I do agree there's times when a woman sure can be a friend of mine. Will I keep on
see clear and inherent weakness of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, we look below to find that the common law principles clearly known to the Bill of Rights do not apply to the 14th Amendment and due process. The right of trial by jury in civil cases guaranteed by the 7th Amendment, Walker versus Sauvignet, and the right to bear arms guaranteed by the 2nd Amendment, Presser versus Illinois, have been distinctly held not to be privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States guaranteed by the 14th Amendment against abridgment by the states. And in effect, the same decision was made in respect of the guarantee against prosecution, except by indictment by grand jury contained in the 5th Amendment, Hurtado versus California, and in respect of the right to be confronted with witnesses contained in the 6th Amendment, West versus Louisiana. In Maxwell v. Dow, Supra, where the plaintiff in error had been convicted in a state court of a felony upon information and by a jury of 8 persons, it was held that the indictment made indispensable by the Fifth Amendment and the trial by jury guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment were not privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, as those words were used in the 14th Amendment. The decision rested upon the ground that this clause of the 14th Amendment did not forbid the states to abridge the personal rights enumerated in the first 8 amendments because these rights were not within the meaning of the clause, privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. We conclude, therefore, that the exemption from compulsory self-incrimination is not a privilege or immunity of national citizenship guaranteed by this clause of the 14th Amendment against abridgment by the states. It goes on to say, it is possible that some of the personal rights safeguarded by the first amendments against national action may also be safeguarded against state action, because the denial of them would be a denial of due process of law. If this is so, it is not because those rights are enumerated in the first 8 amendments, but because they are of such a nature that they are included in the conception of due process of law. Now, that was taken from Twining versus New Jersey. Therefore, any reference to amendments 1 through 8, when applied to the state or through purview of the 14th Amendment in any way, replaces the common law thereof with martial law. This is pure theft of our common law birthright. The first section of the 14th Amendment's purpose is to, number one, convert common law citizens to statutory citizens and statutory persons under martial law rule, and, number two, convert common law remedies, principles, and maxims in Articles 1 through 10 in Amendment to martial law remedies, principles, maxims through the 14th Amendment, and, number three, convert common law rights ownership of property to martial law confiscation of property in which a private citizen is not capable of protecting his property under the common law, and, number four, completely remove the common law jurisdiction from the original people and their posterity and convert them to statutory persons who can be brought within view of the 14th Amendment under national, international, martial law rule, and, number five, completely destroy the restrictions on those not of the white race to enter our nation and dislodge the people mentioned in the preamble as the governing body of this white nation, and, number six, completely destroy the ability of the said people to govern by allowing those not of our race to hold elected office, both state and national. All this is done with the intention of breaking down state sovereignty by an increased power of the national side of the United States government, with a corresponding loss of power for state sovereignty on the federal side of the United States. This leaves the existence of the United States government less dependent, or not dependent at all, upon the existence of the several states. Essentially, the federal government has seceded from the Union. The 14th Amendment set the stage for the destruction of white rule under Christian doctrine in the United States of America. Well, I think that Christian doctrine is bullshit. It just set the stage for the destruction of white rule. Ultimately, they will not succeed, it says, and it goes on to talk about God. As God has designated this land for the regathering of the 12 tribes of Israel to become a mighty nation again, and so it will be as God has proclaimed. Okay, so anyway, forget that last part. We know that's bullshit. However, they did a good job of this otherwise. 14th Amendment, Section 2. The next section of the 14th Amendment reads, Section 2, representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for president and vice president of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive and judicial of the state, or members of the legislature thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such state, being 21 years of age, and the citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged, except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis for representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in such state. For the purpose of the initial sentence of Section 2 is clear by its own terms. Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state. The intention is to give those persons, previously known as chattels, a whole character, and to give that character representation as citizen accordingly, allowing the states to claim those persons for purposes of representation in the United States government. Elk versus Wilkins. Now, what does the original Constitution say on the subject? Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. That was Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution. Under Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, we can see that the framers understood that they would not allow the direct taxation of property in the several states by the United States by including those persons held in servitude as property from apportionment for direct taxes. The only exception made was that of counting those persons at 3/5 of their actual enumeration and adding to the whole number of free persons. At the time of adoption of the Constitution for the United States of America, the southern states feared they would be powerless in the new government due to low population of free persons in those states. A compromise was struck which allowed additional representation for the populace held as slaves, with a corresponding increase in taxation for the additional representation. This carried two benefits with the government. Number one, more revenue would be generated by the United States from these states, and number two, these states would be more likely to ratify the Constitution, having more equal authority in the central government. But even here, representation and direct taxes were not considered on the same level. See 8 Fed Stat Anno 195-1906. The first sentence of Section 2 of the 14th Amendment is wholly in conflict with and in contradiction to Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, as well as the preamble. The only reason these persons or slaves were even given a 3/5 character in the United States Census was for the purpose of taxation, which incidentally prevented the slave states from suffering a lack of sufficient representation in the United States House of Representatives. By no means was this 3/5 character to imply any direct representation of the persons to whom it related. See 8 Fed Stat Anno 107 from 1906. Under the 14th Amendment, if any state refuses to give this class suffrage in state election by the terms of Section 2, 14th Amendment, a disability is imposed. When this disability is imposed, the state subjected to the disability loses the 3/5 representation it had based upon the number of such persons, and for that reason is repugnant to the organic law. Rather than returning a state to its original standing or representation under Article 1 by counting non-whites as 3/5 for purposes of taxation and incidental representation, the uncooperative state is forced into the very condition the framers of the Constitution intended to prevent by the compromise struck at the Constitutional Convention. And since Section 2 of the 14th Amendment makes no mention of taxation, it is presumable that the state would still be taxed according to at least 3/5 apportionment for the number of those persons inhabiting the state, an unequal taxation never intended. See the Federalist Paper number 34. Now, an interesting thought just popped into my head. I guess we're all slaves, so technically we're all three-fifths of a person. So according to the 14th Amendment, everybody, unless you truly are a free person, you're really three-fifths of a person. Think about that for a second. Now, unless you get yourself out of the system and become a non-14th 14th Amendment citizen, you are a slave. Moreover, without the three-fifths disability placed upon non-white, the people mentioned in the preamble to the Constitution for the United States, or rather their posterity, no longer can maintain their superior character over their own government affairs as the founders and sovereignty of the government. This amounts to no less than allowance of a foreign invasion into the several states of the Union, sanctioned by congressional, state, and federal legislation against the people of the states in violation of their respective sovereignties. And how do I end my shows every week? One thing that must be noted, although this disability would be imposed upon the states that were uncooperative, they could still deny such to the subjects of the United States. Clear my throat. In Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, Indians not taxed were still excluded as they are in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. The reason Indians are not taxed were still excluded is because of their allegiance to and membership in a separate racial sovereignty, that is, the Indian nations. See 9 Fed Stat Annotation 626. So now what are the illegal aliens here from Mexico? Ask yourself that. The Court of Elk versus Wilkins later determined that holding Indians outside the consideration for representation was wholly inconsistent with destruction of racial distinction proposed by the 14th Amendment. It is speculated that this decision was made because to decide otherwise would reveal the racial sovereignty principles of the U.S. Constitution in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, and the preamble. The purpose of the 14th Amendment was to destroy the common law ideal that each race constituted a separate sovereignty in their own governments. It should be noted that this principle, the destruction of racial recognition, has now been extended to all races, including artificial juristic persons or corporations. Even though the 14th Amendment initially was put into existence on the proposition that it was only intended to benefit the African race. 8 Fed Stat Annotation 256. The 14th Amendment is to be liberally construed to carry out the purpose of its framers, but it is not to be restricted in its application because designed originally to rectify an existing wrong. The amendment was adopted soon after the close of the Civil War and undoubtedly had its origin in a purpose to secure the newly made citizens in the full enjoyment of their freedom, but it is in no respect limited in its operation to them. It is universal in its application, extending its protective force over all men of every and color within the jurisdiction of the state throughout the broad domain of the Republic. Again, 8 Fed Stat Annotation 256. It is no wonder that this amendment has been held to apply to artificial or juristic persons, since its purpose was to artificially, by operation or fiction of law, confer citizenship on classes never recognized as citizens under common law principles that are based upon the natural law. 14th Amendment, Section 3. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment reads, Section 3, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who have previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against same, given aid or come to the enemies thereof, but Congress may vote of 2/3 of each house remove such disability. Well, I guess they did that for themselves. since they are the ones who actually rebelled. This provision, at first glance, was obviously intended to punish the active Southern participants in the Civil War, but this section, like the rest of the 14th Amendment, later proved to deprive the rights of citizens in the so-called Northern states as well. For instance, under this section, Congress enacted legislation requiring citizens to take an oath of allegiance before being allowed to vote, thus interfering with their right of suffrage and exercise of sovereignty and before obtaining judgments in the courts of the United States, thus interfering with the citizens' right to obtain remedy. I hope we understand what remedy is about. That's what we won't be discussing. Let me light this. The oath spoken of was created during the Civil War and continued thereafter under the martial law of this section of the 14th Amendment. It was created with the intent to circumvent any exercise of state sovereignty, either by conventions of the people of the state or by acts of their legislature, which could interfere with the unauthorized superiority exercised by the United States government through the force of martial law. Now I'm going to read something here that says approved August 6, 1861, Chapter 64, Section 1, 12 Stat 326. It's two paragraphs. It shall be the duty of the heads of the several departments to cause to be administered to each and every officer, clerk, or employee now in their respective departments or in any way connected therein, or who shall hereafter in any way become connected therewith, to following oath, viz., I do solemnly swear or affirm, as the case may be, that I will support, protect, and defend the Constitution and the government of the United States against all enemies, whether domestic or foreign, and that I will bear true faith, allegiance, and loyalty to the same, any ordinance, resolution, or law of any state convention or legislature to the contrary, notwithstanding, and further, that I do this with full determination, pledge, and purpose, without any mental reservation or evasion whatsoever, and further, that I will well and faithfully perform all the duties which may be required of me by law, so help me God. And that each and every such civil officer and employee in the departments aforesaid, or in any way connected therewith, in the service or employment of the United States, who shall refuse to take the oath or affirmation herein provided, shall be immediately dismissed and discharged from such service or employment. And that is called an act requiring an oath of allegiance and to support the Constitution of the United States to be administered to certain persons in the civil service of the United States. Also see oath prescribed for West Point cadets in an act providing for the better organization of the military establishment, approved August 3rd, 1861. Clear my throat. The oath of allegiance was also used in many other relations to obtain a judgment in the courts of the United States and to raise claims in its departments and bureaus. For instance, Congress enacted, the commanders of all American vessels sailing from ports in the United States to foreign ports during the continuance of the present rebellion, and all persons prosecuting claims either as attorney or on his own account before any of the departments or bureaus of the United States, shall be required to take the oath of allegiance and to support the Constitution of the United States, or affirm, as the case may be, as required of persons in the civil service of the United States by the provisions of the Act of Congress approved August 6, 1861. That was from an act requiring the commanders of American vessels sailing to foreign ports and persons prosecuting claims to take the oath of allegiance, which was approved July 17, 1862, Chapter 205, Section 1, 12 Stat 610. Next is an act to establish for investigation of claims against the United States, which is approved February 24, 1855. Approved March 3, 1863, Chapter 152, Section 12, 12 Stat, 765, 767. Provided, however, that in order to authorize the said court to render a judgment in favor of any claimant, if a citizen of the United States, it shall be set forth in the petition that the claimant, in original and every prior owner thereof, where the claim has been assigned, has at all times borne true allegiance to the government of the United States, and whether a citizen or not, that he has not in any way voluntarily aided, abetted, or given encouragement to rebellion against the said government, which allegiance may be traversed by the government, and if on the trial such issue shall be decided against the claimant, his petition shall be dismissed. And the next one here, you take a drag, hold on. I just don't want my cigarette to burn away. This was approved June 25th, 1868, Chapter 71, Section 3, 15, Stat 75. An act to provide for appeals from the Court of Claims and for other purposes. Whenever it shall be material in any suit or claim before any court to ascertain whether any person or party asserting the loyalty of any such person to the United States during its rebellion shall be required to prove affirmatively that such person did during said rebellion consistently adhere to the United States and did give no aid or comfort to persons engaged in said rebellion, and the voluntary residence of any such person in any place where, at any time during such residence, the rebel force organization held sway, shall be prima facie evidence that such person did give aid and comfort to said rebellion and to the persons engaged therein. Also see an act making appropriations for the legislative, executive, and judicial expenses of the government for the year ending 13th of June, 1861, sorry, 71, approved July 12th, 1870. Let me see where I'm at on time. Okay, I got about half an hour here. And let me get back over. Now, I don't know how much longer it's going to take me to get through this, but I have a limited amount of time that I can spend on this. It appears that it's going to be longer than I originally thought it was going to be. I'll go up to 2.5 hours max. If I don't finish, then I'll do a show midweek to wrap it up, but it won't be the next Sunday show. Okay, all of these acts of martial law that require an oath of allegiance from the people who are already citizens, within the original meaning of the Constitution, are given a continuing effect through Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Under these acts created under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, citizens are or could be treated as being guilty of insurrection and rebellion until they prove themselves innocent. This is, again, a reversal of the common law maxim that one is innocent until proven guilty, and contrary to the intent of the Fifth Article in Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. For those who take offense to the use of the terms civil war, as opposed to, say, the war between the states or the war of northern aggression, we will continue to use those terms for a reason. The cause of this war was the attempt of the national government to interfere in the sovereignty of the several states through national civil law. Thus, the actual controversy, political as well as military, is known as the Civil War. This was a war over the intrusion of civil law upon the common law. The court of Diamond versus Harris calls the civil law or statutory law superior equity. From Diamond versus Harris, 1830. It is difficult to see how the courts of the state are to ignore the common law as a rule of decision when it is made so by statute and adopt the civil law, even though it have the merit of superior equity. Now, I just want to throw this out there. Texas, up until the mid-'80s, did have common law courts, which were separate. This no longer ceased to exist because people forgot what the hell they were. And basically just jumped back on. So you can see how American people will be covering. Equity is, oh, wait a minute, let me continue this. Most states have taken the common laws that were on the books and have coded them into the civil code. So one can say that, well, you can't argue common law anymore. It's right here in the civil code. How convenient. Equity has always been understood to follow the law. To have superior equity is to turn things on their head. That is exactly what happens when martial law is imposed. If equity is the law, then it follows its own course rather than following the common law, thereby destroying the common law and leaving what is called equity in its place. We can't even begin to count the number of times judges, lawyers, and statesmen have said, there isn't any common law anymore. It has been replaced by statutes. They would be more truthful if they said, there isn't any common law anymore. It has been replaced by martial law. In 1789, Judiciary Act Section 16 prevented the courts of the United States from entertaining a suit in equity where there was an adequate remedy at law. Section 16, and it be further enacted, that suits in equity shall not be sustained in either of the courts of the United States in any case where plain, adequate, and complete remedy may be had at law. That was taken from an act to establish the judicial courts of the United States, approved September 24th, 1789, Chapter 20, Section 16, 1 Stat 73, 82. Let me clear my throat. The statute was taken from a principle well known to the common law and was made by men who participated in the creation of our Constitution. The civil law that followed the Civil War is found to be this so-called superior equity instituted under the police power created in the 14th and related amendments. This so-called superior equity can only be imposed under conditions of martial law rule where the law is in suspension. If the judiciary has no right to proceed in equity when the law provides adequate remedy, how does the Congress propose to statute the principles of equity, then claim to have made law? It would seem that such a practice is wholly unlawful in light of legal principles known to the Constitution and to the several states at the time of its adoption. As well, it must be noted that martial law is known, for the most part, to follow the course set by men rather than the course set by law, its jurisdiction being based on force and coerced consent. Even where concerned, it may be justified by those opposing it, or eventually will be held liable for damages caused by its imposition. And this is from 8, Attorney General, Op. 365-367, February 3rd, 1857, and says, what is called proclaiming martial law is no law at all, but merely for the sake of public safety in circumstances of great emergency, setting aside all law and acting under military power, a proceeding which requires to be followed by an act of indemnity when the disturbances are at end. The framers understood common law to be superior law in all areas where it could be given effect. In fact, the Constitution for the United States of America incorporates the common law in many of its provisions by using common law terms which only the common law can define. It should not be forgotten that the first laws of the United States carry weight in construction of the powers given in the Constitution of the United States, as well as the lawful manner of instituting those powers. Now, another thing you'll notice here, I'm interjecting, that a lot of your so-called laws in incorporated cities are really codes. They're not laws. So you get pulled over for speeding. Did you violate a law? No. You there's a word I'm looking for, but I can't think of it at the moment. Broken a code. Broken is not really the best word. Violated, not even violated, really. I'll probably think of it after the show is over. Infracted, maybe it's infraction. An infraction of the code. Sounds right. And even your state laws, like I said, have now all been encoded. I mean, you know, think about it. All the laws, common laws, were made years and years ago. You know, what, something along the lines of murder, fraud, theft, you know, robbery, rape. I'm probably missing one or two. And everything else is a variation of that. So how many laws do you really need? You know, let's say you steal something physically in a store, or compare that to, say, you get online, hack into someone's website, access their bank account, steal some money. Well, they've got a law on the books for one and a law on the books for the other. Even though both of them are theft, they make this distinction on how it was done. Now, I can understand making a distinction on how much was stolen, but how you went about doing it doesn't change the fact that they're the same exact thing. But, you know, these people in Congress and all the state legislatures have to justify their existence and have to have something to do all day long. You know, there's so many laws that have been passed. There's no way any single person in this country cannot violate something, if you want to even use the word law, some code from day-to-day activities, just normal day-to-day activities, and you don't even know it. I think most of the time, so-called law enforcement doesn't even know them either. They may know a good portion of them. But so technically, I guess we're all future felons. Some point, you're going to break a law that's probably a felony without realizing it. You know, maybe you farmed some land and some protected animal's habitat was invaded, but it was your land. Thought you could do what you wanted with it, right? Wrong. Next thing you know, you've committed a felony. Okay, back to this article. Let's see, this is from Dred Scott versus Stanford, 1856-1857. Let me clear my throat again. To all this mass of proof we have still to add, that Congress has repeatedly legislated upon the same construction of the Constitution that we have given. Three laws, two of which were passed almost immediately after the government went into operation, will be abundantly sufficient to show this. The two first are particularly worthy of notice, because many of the men who assisted in framing the Constitution and took an active part in procuring its adoption were then in the halls of legislation, and certainly understood what they meant when they used the words "people of the United States" and "citizen" in that well-considered instrument. While the distinction between law and equity are now claimed to be abolished by Rule Number 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the combining of both jurisdictions under a singular procedure can only be done outside the judicial power under martial law rule. Some courts still seem to recognize some distinction in law and equity, probably to avoid explaining the damage done to the judicial child by this combination. Getting back to the point from Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, we can see that the southern states would be disabled from recovering their sovereignty by propositions of this section, because all that were sympathetic to their cause would be and were refused office in the United States government. This was necessary for the northern revolutionaries to maintain the results of their usurpation of the preamble to the Constitution and their imposition of martial law. According to McKee versus Young, all that is necessary to constitute aid and comfort, as known in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, is given the enemy words of encouragement or expression of favorable opinion while occupying an influential position. From this, it is obvious that Southern public officials were targeted for punishment for their attempts to maintain the power of the preamble to the Constitution for the United States, as well as the principles of the federal government known to and required by that instrument. Note, secession of the southern states is not condoned, but recognition that the South seceded due to the Usurpations Act pursued by the national government is intended. The several states did have the right to withdraw their senators from the national government to suspend its operation until such time as it conformed itself to the requirements of the Constitution. It appears that secession was used by the Northern revolutionaries as justification for the acts of a usurpacious national government. This mistake should never be repeated. It has been said that the 13th Amendment and subsequent amendments to the U.S. Constitution bear the same authority as other provisions of the Constitution, being amendments thereto, rather than bearing the inferior quality of statutes, which may be considered void when made without authority of the Constitution as adopted. Not only are these amendments contrary to the original intent of the framers, which recognized only a white sovereignty, we the people, but even Congress has treated the 14th Amendment as a mere statute. It is well known that the Constitution for the United States of America may not be amended by statute, Article 5, Constitution for the United States of America. It is presumable that Congress fully understood this fact. An act of Congress approved June 6, 1898, provides that the disability imposed by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution heretofore incurred is hereby removed. According to Marbury v. Madison, either the Constitution is the supreme and paramount law, unchangeable by mere legislative enactment, or it is a futile attempt by people to control their government. Either the 14th Amendment has no more standing than a statute, or it violates the principles of government proposed by the original Constitution by allowing Congress to change its provisions by its own legislative authority. See Rogers versus Belay, B-E-L-L-E-I, dissenting opinion, as to Congress changing their intent of the 14th Amendment by legislation. This being the case, the 14th Amendment must be something less than organic law. Ironically enough, Madison, the defendant in Marbury versus Madison, supra, in the Constitutional Convention, voting for the ratification of the Constitution by the people rather than the state legislatures, agreed that a legislature could not amend the organic law that put it into existence. William M. Meigs, M-E-I-G-S, of the Philadelphia Bar, in something called The Growth of the Constitution, see Volume 8, Fed Stat Anno Reports Madison's Reviews, 8 Fed Stat Anno 243. It says, Madison thought the legislature is clearly incompetent to ratify the United States Constitution, for the very changes proposed would make essential inroads on the state constitution, and a legislature cannot change the constitution under which it exists. On this and other basis, the Constitution for the United States of America was ratified by conventions of the people of the states rather than the state legislatures. This raises another important question. Were or are the state legislatures competent to ratify amendments to the Constitution, such as the 14th Amendment, which officially changed the state constitution by the inroads made into it? Interesting question. Obviously, the Constitutional Convention thought that state legislatures are incompetent to ratify any organic law that adversely affected or changed their state constitutions. Therefore, this would appear to give further validity to the proposition that the state legislatures may only amend the Constitution for the United States of America according to Article 5 thereof when the purpose of the amendment is to hold the United States government to the limits of its original powers. Ratification of any amendment which expands power of the United States government beyond its original limits must therefore, by any theory, be ratified by conventions of the people of the class mentioned in preamble in their respective states. Let me check on time. Okay, a little less than 15 minutes to the live show. Clear my throat. Okay, this next part here. U.S. versus Morris, 1851. See also Madison and the Federalist, number 41. And 8 Fed Stat, Anno 253. Note, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were not ratified by conventions of the people, and thus those amendments undermined the states' constitutions by depriving both the governments of the several states and the sovereign people of a great deal of their power by purporting to transfer power to the national government. It must also be noted, there is no sounder rule of interpretation of the Constitution than that which requires us, the court, to look at the whole of an instrument before we, referring to the court again, determine a question of construction of any part, particular part. Could this be why there are great efforts being put forth to call a constitutional convention for the purpose of giving final validity to these usurpatious acts of American legislators? Regardless of this fact, it is obvious that the Northern usurpation of the Constitution for the United States of America, favoring international or interracial law, was to be protected from Southern resistance by martial law. By Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the Congress would be allowed to decide when the principles of the preamble were dead and when those who maintained these principles were also dead, or when they were no longer a threat to these usurpatious acts against our Constitution. Considering the weight of the evidence that the 14th Amendment is of martial law jurisdiction, we can begin to understand why it was thought that Congress might repeal the disabilities of Section 3 without a constitutional amendment, outside of the scope of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. Of the Constitution of the United States. Over the years, people have had a great deal of trouble accessing the judicial power of the courts. Since martial law suspends the judicial power with other regular powers of government, this is quite understandable. Congress's power is, practically speaking, unlimited, where the regulation of courts subjected to martial law rule are concerned. Therefore, why would Congress think that their power over the martial law measures in general is limited to the Constitution, especially since Congress claimed power under martial law with the power clauses of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Now, with Obamacare coming up, I'm just interjecting this. I think it would be very important to understand this. You know, and if you could figure out a way to get yourself out of it, other than just saying, I'm not going to pay, whether it be for insurance or a fine. It's my understanding if you don't get insurance, they'll fine you $2,000. Well, that's probably about what your premium would be for insurance for a year. That's per year, by the way. So, I think it would be advantageous to know all of this stuff. A known maxim to the common law is that it supersedes military power. The framers of our national constitution understood this principle when they limited congressional power to make military appropriations to a maximum term of 2 years. Many constituents of the several states also make this clear by requiring the military power to bear arms to remain subordinate to the civil power. For example, the people shall have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. The military power shall be kept in strict subordination of the civil power. That's from the Oregon Constitution, 1859, Article 1, Section 27. The second article and amendment also makes the subordination of the military power to the will of the people clear. Some say we would not adopt the whole of the common law of England. This is true to a certain extent. We did not adopt the monarchy and the feudal law of England. We did adopt so much of the common law as was intended by the framers of the Constitution and those who ratified it. By the ninth article and amendment, it is clear that all rights known to Englishmen were adopted and were to be retained by the people. In addition, the people also assumed unto themselves the powers of sovereignty and the rights related thereto, as clearly indicated by the 10th article and amendment to the Federal Constitution. This is the American common law. In the Declaration of Rights and Resolves from 1774, as well as the Declaration of Independence, 1776, some of the men who framed the Constitution complained of the forces used by the King of England that resulted in the loss of trial by jury in violation of many other rights now known to be protected by the Bill of Rights, or the first 10 Articles of Amendment, to those who may not be from the United States. At the time of American history, the King of England was already using military force or martial law to govern the colonies to deprive Americans of their rights. Therefore, it cannot be presumed that Congress never had the power to use martial law of any form to govern in the several states. Next section. Section 4. Let me light a cigarette here. And cough. Next is Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, and it reads, "The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave. But all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void." As previously in this expose, we will continue to dissect the 14th Amendment with a view to its legal effects, sentence by sentence, continuing with the remaining portion of Section 4 and going on through Section 5. The first sentence of Section 4 provides the following: the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. Basically, they can sic goons on you. For years, several individuals have been questioning the issue and the use of paper money by the national government. Of course, we know the main medium which plagues us is the Federal Reserve note, but in our zeal to uphold the original intent and purpose of our Constitution, these individuals have made a fatal error. They have ignored this provision of the 14th Amendment. Now, I'm going to say something here about money. Now, I'm not saying I'm advocating gold and silver, but if you stop and think just for a second, if we did use gold and silver, the use of paper, for the most part, would only be needed for large transactions. How so? Well, if you stop and think about it, let's say I have 3 mercury dimes, which are 90% silver. If you don't know what a mercury dime is, look it up. It's a dime that preceded 1964, actually 65. And actually, there were Roosevelt dimes after a certain. And even the term mercury dime is not even accurate, but I'm drifting. Well, if you take the weight of those 3 dimes and look at the value of silver, compare that to the cost of gasoline, they ought to be about the same. So technically, a gallon of gas is still 30 cents a gallon. Just not in inflated paper money. So, the average man may only earn, say, $100 a week in gold and silver, but still has the purchasing power of, say, $2,000, whatever, $1,500 a week. So you see the correlation of what's being made. You know, if you have small amounts only in coin and gold and silver, and you only use paper for large transactions, that to me doesn't really become an issue. And I understand everybody's gripe that, well, he who controls the gold can set the value of it. While that may be true, if you have a proper government, it'll set the value appropriately, and it cannot be tampered with. So, anyway, I will continue. Let me relight the cigarette I just lit. The arguments that have been used against these bills of credit have always focused on Article 1, Section 8, Constitution for the United States of America. For instance, we know that Congress is empowered to coin money, not print it. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, Constitution for the USA. The Congress shall have power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Under this clause, the Congress fixed the unit of measure for money coined by the United States at 416 grains of standard silver, calling the unit of measure a dollar. This made the dollar's silver a standard by which all other money, foreign as well as domestic, would be measured. As a result, there is no such thing as a gold standard in the United States. Congress has the power to change the weight of a gold dollar without affecting the standard in silver. In fact, the Congress is duty-bound to change the gold coin when it no longer reflects a true comparative value to the standard, meaning a dollar of silver. Let me clear my throat. Consequently, legislation can be found prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment, changing the amount of gold contained. Don't forget that the dollar reflects a unit of silver. When the term dollar is used with respect to gold, it becomes a comparative term between the value of gold and silver, with silver being the constant, and gold, in a sense, being given a respective value according to true economic conditions. The only way one could avoid being compelled to accept a gold dollar of lesser weight for the completion of contracts was to make a specific reference to the weight of gold to be transferred for payment, thus treating the gold as a commodity rather than a monetary unit for the purposes of the specific contract, meaning legal tender cases. Although Congress had the power concerning gold currency, Congress cannot be deemed to have power to pass legislation which intended to reflect, other than the parity between the standard of measure being dollars and silver and the gold dollar. To do so would be to deprive those contracting in gold dollars of property without due process of law, and that they could not recover the true intrinsic value of their contracts. This would violate the fourth article in amendment by seizing property without warrant or probable cause upon oath or affirmation, which would violate the fifth article in amendment by either taking private property for public use without just compensation or by depriving property without due process of law. The question is, can the Congress issue paper and declare it to have an unrelated value in gold or silver, or can it issue the same without redemption and force these bills of credit to circulate among private citizens by operation of law? There is sufficient authority in the original Constitution to show that Congress was never intended to exercise such a power, or at least not to exercise its power in such a way. In the Constitutional Convention, Sherman, in relation to Article 1, Section 10, Constitution of the United States, said that he thought this was a favorable moment for crushing paper money. This was an extension of the Convention's determination to prevent the evils of paper money already manifested by striking out from the powers of Congress the power to emit bills on the credit of the United States. It should be noted that only the states were directly prohibited from interfering in the obligation of contracts. During the House and Senate debates on House Joint Resolution 192 of June 5, 1933, this prohibition was brought into view, and it was answered that the prohibition did not apply to the federal government. While this may be true, the Fourth and Fifth Articles in Amendment of the Bill of Rights accomplished the same thing by prohibiting the seizure of property without warrant or deprivation of property without due process of law. A man has property in his contracts, and if the obligations of contract are interfered with, then that property is deprived of the parties to the contract. If this deprivation takes place without proper judicial proceedings conducted within the limitations of the rights, the taking of property is without the authority of law. How interesting. So, me and a plan checker went round and around on some issues here recently. My set of plans met the building code for the city of Houston. The plan checker requested or required that I put more information on there to satisfy his whim. I challenged him on that concept. Told him he was a fascist pig. I didn't use exactly those words, however. And I don't mean to deride fascism. However, we understand where I'm coming from when I say that term. Let me cough. one of the things I told him is he was entering with the contract with my client. Additionally, there was extra cost involved that I was failing to be compensated for, as the plan already met the building codes, which technically, under what should be our system here, should not even exist. However, that's a whole other argument, okay? But for the sake of argument, we presume that building codes should be required. So I told him I was going to send him him personally an invoice for my time. Anyway, I will discuss that further at another time. So, anyway, when the question of bills of credit in relation to the power of Congress was raised in the convention, the power was offered with the clause to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Governor Morris moved to strike out the words and emit bills on the credit of the United States. Madison thought it would be enough to prohibit them from being made a tender. Ellsworth thought this a favorable moment to bar the door against paper money. Read that the words, if not struck out, would be as alarming as the remark of the beast in Revelation. Okay. On this basis, the words were struck out by 9-2. It is obvious from the convention, as well as the powers granted to Congress concerning coinage of money and borrowing of money on the credit of the United States, that no direct or implied power was given to Congress for circulation of its evidences of debt as currency. While Congress has the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, the Congress has no power to force anyone to lend to the government, much less the power to spend debt into circulation without the intention of repayment whatsoever, as in the case of Federal Reserve notes, which are only promises to pay and are not payment. It's kind of like a check. The check is simply a promise to pay. As a result of the money or credit question raised by the fourth section of the 14th Amendment, we find it necessary to review the legal tender cases. For the most part, those cases were decided during and after the Civil War Reconstruction period, when martial law was in full bloom in the United States. By looking at these cases in this new light, much can be gained in the way of understanding the money issue, as well as the Constitution in general. From the legal tender cases, we first see that the Supreme Court of the United States initially declared the legal tender statutes of February 25, 1862, July 11, 1862, and March 3, 1863, to be upheld as war measures exceptional in their character, not authorized by any express grant of the power to Congress contained in the Constitution, but as not prohibited by its terms, and as justified in view of the great public exigencies which required their adoption. In other words, paper money was declared legitimate as martial law money, an emergency war measure. The Supreme Court in Thorington v. Smith, in an opinion dealing with the judgments of the Confederate courts relating to property dispute in that case, made a statement that is applicable to this early decision favoring legal tender laws made during the hostilities of the Civil War. The court said in Thorington, "But such a judgment in such time has little authority." Although this was said in relation to Confederate judgments, the principle still applies. In times of war, during imposition of martial law, the will to win and martial law may override all true logic, even down to the principles of the organic law. It appears that the Supreme Court held to this principle in the case of Hepburn versus Griswold. In Hepburn Supra, the Supreme Court reasoned that the exigency which allowed the legal tender character to be accorded to the Civil War greenbacks was over. Thus, the conditions which implied the power to make them legal tender had ended. Thus, the law could no longer be held constitutional as in the past. The dissenting opinion of the Chief Justice in a later legal case supports the holding of the Hepburn Court case from 1870. The majority of the court, as then constituted, 5 judges to 8, felt obliged to conclude that an act making more promises to pay dollars a legal tender in payments of debts previously contracted is not a means appropriate, plainly adapted, really calculated to carry into effect any express power vested in Congress, is inconsistent with the spirit of the Constitution, and is prohibited by the Constitution. See how amazing the 14th Amendment is? The opinion of Hepburn was ordered to be published on January 29, 1870, and was decided in conference on November 27, 1870. And this is from Juilliard versus Greenman, 1884. The act of Congress and passage of the first Legal Tender Act was placed distinctly upon the ground of the existing imperative need of government, and the Legal Tender Clause was urged and adopted as a war measure, meaning martial law, of course. See, the 14th Amendment truly is a masterpiece of deception. As many of us know, this is not the first time that the government has claimed certain implied powers as an expedient of war or some other emergency. Martial law measures have consistently been imposed upon under the guise of emergencies of all kinds, Roosevelt being the greatest offender since Lincoln. The Hepburn Court, without directly overruling its previous judgment, upholding the legal tender acts, merely declared that the exigency no longer existed and that continued enforcement of the statute must be declared unconstitutional. After the Hepburn ruling, the United States Attorney General, in the cases of Knox versus Lee and Parker versus Davis, moved to be heard on the Hepburn question, Juilliard versus Greenman, supra. These cases were heard almost a year after the Hepburn case, with the court reconstituted. Congress has passed an act allowing for an additional justice, and one of the justices concurring in the Hepburn case had retired. These are the conditions under which the question was reheard. Although the concurring justices in the Hepburn case had not changed their opinion, the legal tender clauses were upheld, 5 justices to 4, thus overturning Hepburn versus Griswold directly. Many have said this was a packed court, and this may be true. But the court wasn't packed merely to overturn Hepburn. Rather, it was packed to assure that the recent and most controversial 14th Amendment would be upheld in its entirety. The legal tender question, as we shall see, was merely an incident of the 14th Amendment because of the words of Section 4. Let me clear my throat. In 1870, the reconstituted court, for the most part, claimed to base its ruling overturning Hepburn on the grounds laid out in the dissenting opinion of the Hepburn case. The only real difference in the opinions of the Hepburn court in this later legal tender case, Knox and Parker, was that the dissenting opinion of Hepburn became the concurring opinion of Knox and Parker, and the concurring opinion of Hepburn became the dissenting opinion of Knox and Parker. It was noticed by the dissenting opinion of Justice Field that the court failed to give any reason for overturning Hepburn. The question arises, with the turmoil and flat disloyalty and usurpations involved in adoption of the 14th Amendment still remaining vivid in 1870, did the court dare to go to the fourth section of the 14th Amendment for the additional law it needed to justify such an upset in the Supreme Court? Note, the 14th Amendment was never touted as an amendment that would allow Congress a legal power to force paper money on American citizens. Justice Field begins his dissent. Legal tender cases 12. Nothing has been heard from counsel in these cases, and nothing from the present majority of the court, which has created a doubt in the mind of the correctness of the judgment rendered in the case of Hepburn versus Wall, or of the conclusions expressed in the opinion of the majority of the court, has then constituted. That judgment was reached only after repeated arguments were heard from able and eminent counsel, and after every point raised on either side had been the subject of extended deliberation. Obviously, no one had the courage to directly raise the 14th Amendment in defense of the legal tender statutes. And in fact, you will not find any direct reference to it in the arguments of counsel or the majority opinion of Knox and Parker Supra. Had the case turned on this point, there may have been another civil war spilling more blood than the last. While we do not wish to go into great detail about the concurring and dissenting opinions in these cases, the court did say some things that we will find important to this discussion. A study of the history of the 14th Amendment clearly reveals the injustice done by the amendment, as well as the injustice done to obtain assent of the states to adopt it. The court in Knox and Parker admits that Congress, by its legal tender law, if declared unconstitutional, has done a disastrous thing. And again, this is from legal tender cases. Indeed, legal tender treasury notes have become the universal measure of value. If now, by our decision, it be established that these debts and obligations can be discharged only by gold coin, it, contrary to the expectations of the parties to these contracts, legal tender notes are rendered unavailable. The government has become an instrument of the grossest injustice. Legal tender law itself, the government has become the instrument of gross injustice to the right parties who had contracted for specie payments. Now the court is worried that the injustice really done will be revealed. Congress also was worried about this, and that is why we have a provision in the 14th Amendment, disallowing any question of the validity of the public debt, that is, the validity of Congress's action. No one can question this action. Then how can the injustice be revealed? Let me clear my throat. It is further said by the court, it is incumbent upon those who affirm the unconstitutionality of an act of Congress to show clearly that it is in violation of the provisions of the Constitution. And again, from legal tender cases. It must be noted that the litigants against paper money never addressed the validity of the four sections of the 14th Amendment. No one contested the constitutionality of the fourth section. And while the court alluded to its principles, direct reference to it is avoided like the plague. Throughout all the legal tender cases, the justices, in opposition to legal tender, present a most compelling legal argument, as well as historical facts and motives of the framers and the people of the states as references to show that Congress had no power to enact a legal tender law making paper acceptable as money. Same thing, power, paper. As ruled in Hepburn versus Griswold. If looking only at the original organic law, as the Hepburn court did, these arguments are absolutely valid. But we must remember that we are not dealing only with the original organic law, and neither was the Supreme Court after the unconstitutional adoption of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is claimed to be a part of the organic law, no matter how false or erroneous that assumption may be. Also, in reviewing these legal tender decisions, don't forget that the Supreme Court is always on notice of the Constitution in its entirety, whether they mention any of its specific provisions or not in their opinions. In four Supreme Court justices, four Supreme Court justices won't be heeded when relating the true history and meaning of our original Constitution, where can we expect to prove our point merely on the same grounds they raised, without dissuading the effect of subsequent called amendments? This is exactly what we have done, but not as well as Justice Field and his fellow justices. It seems like a very huge problem. All can be said in the Supreme Court about the original Constitution, of paper money, has been said by its own justices, and with one exception, the relationship that the 14th Amendment bears to the subject, and the fact that the 14th Amendment is mere fiction, not part of the Constitution. This question has been raised. We must answer the question proposed by Justice Field: what allowed Hepburn to be overturned? Let us look at some of the things said by the litigants. If we are right about the implication of the fourth section of the 14th Amendment, then some reference must have been made to it, even if only indirectly. You might say that the validity of the public debt has nothing to do with paper currency or currency in general. The Attorney General of the United States, in arguing for paper money, disagrees. In legal tender case, says there is a kinship between the borrowing of money and the issuing of a currency made valuable by being invested with all the facilities of money and evidence of that borrowing. Interestingly enough, no references made to the 14th Amendment by the Attorney General when this statement was made, while the language relates directly to the provisions of the fourth section. Again, from the legal tender cases, a decent respect for a coordinate branch of government demands that the judiciary should presume until the contrary is clearly shown that there has been no transgression of power of Congress. Remember, new power was conferred upon Congress, more plenary in its character than ever before, with the exception of the 13th Amendment, as you will see in our discussion of this section of the 14th Amendment coming up. Now, let's see here. I was wanting to mention something else, but I kind of just lost my train of thought. I guess I'll hopefully think of it before the show. Oh, I remember what it was. What's interesting, and I'm not trying to say anything in particular by making this statement, you'll notice in the Declaration of Independence a reference to Britain or the crown, the king, whatever the case may be. I don't remember its exact wording. Assumed the powers to make essentially any law it wanted to. And what does Congress do? Congress does the same thing in the Constitution. It's almost like they took the complaint made in the Declaration of Independence and said, okay, we're going to give it to Congress. Let them have the power to do it. So it's like they already had all this power to begin with. And now, supposedly here, if we're reading this right, it now has even more power? I don't know. It depends on how you want to read the wording, and I don't have it in front of me. Maybe I'll go back to it one day on some show. I've mentioned it once. If you go back to the interview of me by Kyle on the old Deep Oracle Network, which is in my archives here on Renegade page for my bio, you will find that I bring that issue up. Power conferred on Congress, more plenary in its character than ever before, with the exception of the 13th Amendment. Oh, I just read that. And speaking of the powers of Congress, from legal tender, it is allowable to group together any number of them and infer from them that all the power claimed has been conferred. What about the new power of the 14th Amendment? The court admits that the Bill of Rights was intended to curtail the questionable powers of Congress that may be implied. These amendments are denials of power, and that's from the legal tender cases, and refers to the preamble of the Bill of Rights as setting that standard. This is a further discussion with reference to who is competent to amend the Constitution and under what conditions. But right after the court says this, for the most part, the Bill of Rights is disregarded. Why does the 14th Amendment supersede the Bill of Rights, where the power exercised is a direct power conferred after their adoption? The answer? The limitations of the Bill of Rights are common law principles, while the 14th Amendment is martial law. When martial law is put into effect, it is used to suspend the common law, rightly or otherwise, and therefore supersedes it. From the standpoint of constitutional construction, and this is from 9 Fed Stat, and if there be any conflict between an amendment and a provision of the original Constitution, the provision found in the amendment must control, under the rule that the last expression of the will of the lawmaker prevails over an earlier one. This also raises the question, who is the lawmaker if there is to be a change in the members of the sovereign body? It is not the sovereign body itself, rather than their creations, state legislature or Congress. Is it not the sovereign body itself, rather than their creations, meaning state and legislatures or Congress? It is said that the Congress has power to borrow the United States, and the power to emit bills of credit is to that power. But the court relates that when the legal tender laws were passed, it was the fact that the credit of the United States had run out, which caused the exigency or emergency requiring a legal tender law. Meanwhile, the public treasury was nearly empty, and the credit of the government, if not stretched to its utmost tension, had become nearly exhausted. That last statement, also from legal tender cases. If the credit is exhausted, where is the power to borrow on the credit of it or any implied power under it? But this is not true if the validity of the debt cannot be questioned. 14, Section 4. The basic reasoning of the concurrent court in Knox and Parker was that Congress has the power to declare war and repel insurrection, meaning powers of martial law. From this power is the implied power to make war or the power to execute such war, implied power of martial law. Coupled with war powers, meaning martial law powers, is the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. When the credit of the United States runs out or is short, an emergency exists, an excuse for imposition of martial law measures, and under the war powers, loans may be forced. Under this implied power to enforce loans, the government may issue bills of credit evidencing the debt and the force enforce their acceptance by declaring them legal tender. Here we see an implication of power not directly given in its fourth generation of all justified under the power of martial law. This is stretching things to say the least, and we have already discussed the borrowing power being extinguished when the credit of the United States becomes non-existent. The consequence of a marriage between the war powers and the emergency borrower when there is no credit to borrow against is legal tender paper money, which would be better called martial law money. Let me clear my throat. Well, we're approaching the 2.5 hour mark here. I don't know whether to continue or not. I don't know that I can get through the fifth section in the next half hour. And I've got stuff I've got to do. So I'm just going to go ahead right now and consider that a good stopping point. And during a show during the week, I will finish this off. And a new topic will be on the table next Sunday. So anyway, let me get back to my notes. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Well, you've been hearing it. Close out with some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate, only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate, it's about survival. You have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-war. Free men are equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right from multiracialism. It is not self-government. People's association. If you are a state, if you are a state, tell